to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 8th, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're hosting an update on two new lawsuits, one against Harvard and one against the University of North Carolina. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. I'm told by my staff here that our real-time reminder email for this call has not yet hit. That's a problem with our email service here. The scheduled reminder hasn't gone out, so we're going to begin the call anyhow, even with a lesser populated call than we might normally expect. We're going to have opening remarks from each of our experts of about 5 to 10 minutes each. A reminder to our audience, this is an ongoing litigation, so there are some aspects and probably responses to questions that you might not get from our attorneys who are involved in this litigation. We'll hear first from Edward Bloom. He's the director of the Project on Fair Representation. And then we'll hear from Will Consovoy. He is a partner at the new law firm, Consovoy and McCarthy, right here in the Washington, D.C. area. As I said, they're going to speak for 5 to 10 minutes each, and then we'll take questions from the audience. So please do be ready with your questions. With that, Mr. Bloom, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. I want to take my time to describe the genesis of both of these lawsuits, and then let Will Consovoy talk about the law, our strategy to some degree, and the status of both. The genesis of both the Harvard complaint and the UNC complaint really began shortly after the Supreme Court handed down its opinion in Fisher versus the University of Texas. As many of you are aware, the court, although not getting to the constitutionality of affirmative action, raised the hurdles that universities must overcome before turning to race-based affirmative action. I and Will and Tom and many others thought that that was a very significant opinion, and we anticipated colleges and universities throughout the country taking some action in amending and changing their admissions policies. About 4 or 5 months after the opinion came down, June of 2013, no progress had been made, in our opinion, by any university to adhere to the new strict scrutiny standards that Fisher handed down. So to that end, a new litigation project was born, and it started with the identification of three schools, Harvard, UNC, and the University of Wisconsin. Those three schools were targeted by the Project on Fair Representation as being what we believe egregious violators of the very strict standards that universities can use in applying race to their admissions policies. So to that end, the Project on Fair Representation designed and launched three new websites, harvardnotfair.org, UNCNotFair.org and UWNotFair.org. All three of those websites were launched in April of 2014, and press conferences were given in various cities in those states. Those websites garnered not a significant amount of press coverage, but enough press coverage that the Harvard website attracted a little over 300 individuals who had been rejected from Harvard. UNC attracted about 200, Wisconsin about 150. So we considered that a very successful launch. The kids that told us their story, the websites are still live and active. The kids that told us their story described their grades, their ACT and SAT scores, and their extracurricular activities. And then we reached out to a handful of them to see if they would be willing to go forward with an actual lawsuit. We formed an organization called Students for Fair Admissions. Will can go into some detail about the options that we faced in finding or designing a plaintiff to sue these three schools. In November, Students for Fair Admissions had a small group of students who had been rejected from Harvard and a small group who had been rejected from UNC, and we filed suit. The suits then garnered a lot of attention, and I would say perhaps another 200 individuals joined Students for Fair Admissions, this new 501c3 organization that is the plaintiff challenging both Harvard and UNC. So that's the story of really how this came about. And I will I'll ask Will to tell us a little bit more about the law and what our allegations are.
Absolutely. Thank you. What I thought I might do is sort of give you an overview of the kinds of allegations we're making in these cases and how the two cases are the same and different, and walk through it that way. So with respect to Harvard, we are essentially making two kinds of claims against Harvard. The first set of claims, and there are five of them, have to do with Harvard's failure to follow existing law, existing Supreme Court precedent. And all of these claims arise under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which Harvard is bound to follow because it accepts millions of dollars of federal funds. The five kinds of allegations we're making against Harvard are as follows. First, Harvard is intentionally discriminating against Asian American applicants. What we see and what the complaint goes through is a long and sordid history at Harvard of discriminating against minority groups, particular minority groups, that are high achieving and whose population they want to limit on their campus. As many people on the call might know, or if you read your complaint, you'll find out, Harvard has a long and sorry history of discrimination against Jewish applicants that goes back to the 1920s. And what we've seen here is a repeat of that same pattern against Asian American applicants at Harvard. So that is a straightforward claim of intentional discrimination on the basis of race. That is about as straightforward a Title VI claim as you're ever going to see. The second claim we're making is that, and it's a related claim, is that Harvard is engaged in racial balancing, meaning Harvard is attempting to set up essentially ranges of admissions for each racial category, and each year they try to hit that range. So Harvard has a range for Asian Americans, for white, for African American, for Hispanic. And each year, if you look at Harvard statistics, they're about the same for each group. And when you look over time and see how much change there has been in the size and the composition of Harvard's applicant pool, it defies plausibility that you could maintain numbers that consistent over a decade-long period of admissions unless you were intentionally trying to do so. Racial balancing has been banned by the Supreme Court. It has been banned for a long time, most specifically in the Parents Involved decision. And so, that is a straightforward claim as to why Harvard is violating current precedent. The third claim of that brand is that Harvard is using race in a far more predominant fashion than is permitted by Grutter and Gratz. Those decisions, for good or bad, say that Harvard or any school can use race as one non-predominant factor, as a way of admitting a broadly diverse class. If you look at what Harvard's doing for the reasons I've already set forth, that's not what's happening there. Race is the decisive factor, especially for Asian American applicants. Asian American applicants not only represent a substantial portion of Harvard's applicant pool, they are perhaps the biggest portion of any group of the highly admittable applicant pool. I think it's something in the range of near 50%. And yet their admissions range around 17%. Only if you're using race as the criteria for admission could that ever happen. The fourth claim we're making against Harvard under current precedent is their failure to follow what is known as the Harvard Plan. Back in 1978, Supreme Court had a decision, Bakke, which set the table for Grutter, for those who have followed all these cases. And Harvard told the Supreme Court in that case that they only use race to fill the last few places in their class. So everybody, almost the entire class, gets filled on merit or race-neutral criteria, and then only in those last couple places when they're trying to decide between a couple students, one a violin player, someone from a poor community, and perhaps using race, would race be a factor. For the reasons we've set forth in our complaint and I've sort of laid out here already, no way is that happening at Harvard. And the last claim under governing precedent is Harvard's failure to use race-neutral alternatives. Schools like Cal Berkeley, schools like in Florida and Texas and other places have shown that you can accomplish diversity without using race by giving preferences to poorer students, by eliminating legacy preferences, by providing more financial aid, and a host of other factors. Harvard, notwithstanding its massive endowment, doesn't give nearly as much money in financial aid as other schools. And they don't take account of economic status nearly to the weight they give to race. And if they did, they could get away from race altogether. And under Fisher, as Edward pointed out, which we think is a very important opinion, they are required to do so. The last claim, and this is the different one, is notwithstanding all of these arguments and all of these issues, we assert that the Supreme Court should overturn any opinion that allows the use of race. That includes Grutter, that includes Bakke, that includes parents involved. We believe that this case will show once and for all that those decisions were predicated on mistakes of fact as to what these universities do, mistakes of law in interpreting the 14th Amendment, and ultimately that these universities are not responsible enough to use the awesome power of race in the limited way the Supreme Court says they might be allowed to under narrow circumstances. So that's the Harvard complaint. The North Carolina complaint, very briefly, covers many of these same points, but it focuses much more heavily on the excessive use of race in violation of Grutter and the failure to use race-neutral alternatives. And one point I would make about North Carolina was, and one of the reasons we sued them, is they wrote an amicus brief in Fisher that said, we did our own internal study, and we determined that if we used race-neutral criteria instead of race, such as a top 10% plan, we would actually increase diversity at our university. Yet we're not going to do it because it would cause a trivial drop in our SAT scores. We don't think that's sufficient reason to continue to use race, and that is an issue, you know, we will be litigating against them, and I think the principal issue we will be litigating against them. So with that, Dean, I will turn it back over to you.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We've got quite a few people on the call, so I do want to get to their audience questions. We'll do that momentarily. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Before we get to that, let me just make a quick announcement about some upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about Common Core, what is it and is it inevitable. And then Monday, we'll have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum talking about the Reed versus Town of Gilbert case. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case concerning free speech and religious liberty. That's going to be argued in the court on Monday. With that, we've got two questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone, and you can join the queue. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Paul Salamanca at the University of Kentucky. I have an administrative question and then two more conceptual questions. The administrative question is whether your complaints are available on the web somewhere.
This is
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was going to answer the question as you pose them. This is Edward Bloom. You can find both complaints at studentsforfairadmissions.org. That's studentsforfairadmissions.org. Sorry to have interrupted your question.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much. My two more doctrinal questions are, in your complaint, do you talk about the issue of self-identification, which came up in the oral argument at Fisher? It seems to me if you pushed on that, a couple of justices might say that you really don't, whatever the purposes of diversity might be, you don't really achieve them if you rely on self-identification for purposes of racial identity. And the other issue, and it's also coming from the oral argument in Fisher, is whether you push on the question of diversity within classes. It seems to me that if you have diversity across an entire campus but not within classes, your pedagogical goals really aren't being served. I'm just curious whether you push on these or whether you're just relying on gross statistics exclusively. Thanks.
Yeah, I'll take this. Is Will Constable. I'm happy to answer those questions.
Thank you.
On the first one on self-identification, a couple points. One is we have talked about the identification issue, you know, mm-hmm. particularly with the Asian American community. There's what we refer to as a lumping problem. You know, Asia's massive population with people of disparate experiences and cultural backgrounds, you know, Indian versus Chinese, and we come up with so many others. And yet Harvard lumps them all together. So to some extent, we talk about it through that prism. But secondly, it's not clear. Texas allowed self-identification. It's not clear exactly what's going on with respect to self-identification at Harvard and North Carolina. We'll be interesting to see what they say in their pleading about this, and we'll evaluate how to handle it from there. But I would point out that with respect to undergraduate applicants, you are required. Everyone likes to say that you don't have to put your race on your application, but if you look at the common application, you are required to list your parents' countries of origin. We think what's going on is they're identifying whether no matter how you're self-identifying, there's a likelihood that they're doing their own identification on their end. And so, you know, we're gonna have to wait and see how that issue plays out. On classroom diversity, you know, that's, we'll see what, again, I don't want to avoid your question, but this is obviously ongoing litigation, and we'll see what these schools have to say about why, whether they are diverse or not diverse, and why that is so, and we'll respond based on the arguments they make.
So you don't have any motions back yet or answers?
No. The answer dates, Harvard's date is February 18, and North Carolina's it will be behind that by at least a few weeks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ed Bloom, do you have anything on this point?
No, I think Will did a good job in answering that. Other than just a one casual observation that's been made, not only for students applying to Harvard, but also other Ivy League students, other Ivy League schools, that often Asians are now going to the process of having their names changed in order to sound more Anglo-Saxon. And this has been documented in a handful of studies recent media story. So it's it really strikes to the heart of what's happening in Ivy League schools to Asians.
Well, it's a question I was wanting to ask myself. The defendants here are Harvard and University of North Carolina. Just how. Do you want to talk about just how ubiquitous you think this phenomenon is, the use of a hard cap or a quota when it comes to admission of Asian Americans?
Well, as Will said, I think there have been a handful of studies that we cite in our complaint. Ron Unz did one 4 or 5 years ago. We cite a couple of others much more recently. And the admissions data for all the Ivy Leagues is readily available just through a couple of Google searches. And the pattern, the range of admittees is shockingly the same year after year after year. And as Will pointed out, it is our belief and the belief of many scholars that the Asian pool, the highly qualified Asian pool, has actually come close to doubling over the last 10 to 12, 15 years. So Harvard's numbers are really not that different from Yale and not that different from Princeton. It is ubiquitous, and it is rather shocking. Will, do you have anything to add to that?
That covers it. Yeah.
Okay.
We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to another caller.
This is David Tryon in Cleveland, Ohio. You didn't mention, and I guess I'm interested in knowing what relief you're seeking. Are there any monetary damages you're seeking, or just a declaratory judgment, or injunctive relief?
I can take this, Edward. This is Will Consovoy.
Sure.
We are not seeking monetary damages. We are seeking declaratory relief. We are seeking injunctive relief. And as part of that injunctive relief, obviously as a declaratory matter, we're seeking to declare that both these schools are in violation of current precedent. We are seeking declaratory relief to overturn, you know, any case that allows the use of racial preferences. And we are backing that up with injunctive relief to enforce that. And we believe that it will be shown in these cases that we will need an injunction that requires truly race-blind admissions to keep these schools from discriminating on the basis of race. And so how that would be tailored is obviously a question for well down the road, but we are seeking that kind of injunctive relief.
If you're successful, can you get attorney's fees?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
All right, we've got two questions pending. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you'd like to join.
This is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity. And first of all, congratulations to both of you for the great work that you're doing. I had two questions. One is if you could just talk a little bit about how these cases you think will fit in with the Fisher litigation. As I understand it, there's going to be another cert petition filed in Fisher in the next month or two. And then the other question I had is more technical. But it's whether by setting up this new organization that's the plaintiff in both lawsuits, you think that you might be able to maintain more privacy for the students who've been discriminated against.
Will, why don't I answer Roger's question about the sort of anonymity of our plaintiffs, and I'll let you address the other two. Roger, we have explained to every student who has joined Students for Fair Admissions and has told us about his or her sort of academic background, that in all likelihood, at some point, their names will be made public. The court will, it's very likely Harvard will want to know who these students are, and the court will compel us to disclose them. They understand, all of them now understand, that their names will be made public, perhaps in the media. They, like Abigail Fisher and Grutter and Gratz, may be contacted by people who support them or in opposition to them, and they're all aware of that. So I guess my answer has some future context as well, and that is we are actively looking for other students who have been denied admission to other schools, and we would very much welcome this audience to look through their Rolodexes and send kids our way. With the understanding that their names and identities will perhaps one day be public, and they should prepare themselves for that. So all of our plaintiffs are aware that could happen. Will, go ahead.
Yeah. On the Fisher question, Roger. You know, obviously the cases are related. You know, Fisher has been a case and that has been litigated under governing precedent exclusively, and arguing that Texas cannot meet their burden on race-neutral alternatives. And, we stand by that argument, and we think we have a very strong case, as we have for a long time. Given the nature of Texas's arguments on remand, we think it's only gotten much stronger. And so that will certainly be the focus of that case. And this case, we think, in some respects, you know, picks up where that one leaves off. And but it certainly, you know, they're related. Obviously, they go to whether, you know, whether governing precedent is capable of addressing these issues at all. If they can't address them in Fisher, I suppose they can't address them anywhere, because it seems like the easiest case to strike down a program I've seen. But, you know, obviously what happens in that case will certainly matter to how we proceed with these. But how they ultimately end up playing off each other, I think, is we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you.
We've got two questions pending now. Plenty of time for other questions. Push the star button and then the pound button to join the conversation. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Stanley Cook from the Washington, D.C. area. I've met both of you one time or another. I have a question that is not directly on topic, but fairly close. Where someone is admitted, but on a scholarship program that excludes white males. This is a public institution I'm referring to. Any comment?
Stanley, it doesn't sound kosher to me. Will, what do you think?
I'd have to look at it, but, you know, obviously, you know, the court has, you know, Supreme Court has a real problem with set-asides, and you know, you have to make certain showings about histories of discrimination, so we'd have to know more about the institution and what's happening, but it certainly sounds problematic to me as well.
Yeah, Stanley, is this particular scholarship being administered by a public university, or is it being administered and funded by a public university?
It's being administered. The funds are private, but it's being administered. The program is announced and run by a public university.
Well, Will will know better than I, but it gets complex. If the funds have come from an alumni organization that is not affiliated with the university, or some other 501c3 that's not affiliated with the university, but the university just merely advertises the availability of this race-specific scholarship, there's just so many variables that I'd hate to venture a guess.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'd have to look at it to know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, just one question pending now. Let's take another call.
Hey, this is Andrew Brasher from the state of Alabama. Will, I have a question for you. If you could just go into a little bit more detail about your claims against Harvard, specifically that being a private university, at least as I understood it when I attended, and how you've got a cause of action against them on this basis. I was also wondering if you could talk a little bit about the judge draws that you've got in North Carolina and Massachusetts. I don't know anything about the judges there, but I thought it might be interesting to know who you've drawn.
Sure. Good to hear from you. On the cause of action against Harvard, it is a claim under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. The way it works is anyone who accepts federal funds fills out a form, and on that form they sign and agree that any program or institution of the university that accepts those funds agrees to be bound by Title VI. And Harvard has signed that form year after year. Supreme Court in Bakke and in Grutter held that Title VI is coterminous with the 14th Amendment. So if it violates the 14th Amendment, it violates Title VI. And so other than the funding being the hook for the cause of action, it being technically under Title VI instead of the 14th Amendment, it is exactly the same as a traditional 14th Amendment case. On our judge draws, you know, I don't have their names in front of me, unfortunately, but our draw in Boston is a appointee by President Obama, and I believe our judge in the Middle District of North Carolina is an appointee by President Bush. But I haven't, to be candid, dug into their backgrounds and history too much to know much more about them than that. I know in Boston we will have a magistrate judge who will be handling a lot of the day-to-day stuff, and I don't think we know who that is yet. Or if we do, I haven't spent too much time studying that yet. Wait till the answer is filed. And North Carolina, we know, again, we just don't know too much yet. But we will certainly be looking to find out more about them ourselves.
We've got no questions pending. Let me make another call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we got somebody from the West Coast ringing in here, so let's take that call.
David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley. Question has to do with more about the timing of bringing this case and the makeup of the courts, the kind of the judges you're going to be in front of, and eventually the Supreme Court, if it runs to that. And whether or not this is the right time or perhaps waiting a little bit longer, and for the different types of outcomes, an adverse outcome or a positive outcome. Because in some of the cases that we've seen in the past, when you actually get to the individual justices of the Supreme Court, that's where all the difference is being made.
Edward, do you want me to take that, or do you want to take that?
Why don't you start, and I'll gather my thoughts to see if I have anything to add to what you say.
The question, in terms of the timing, the timing is in large part driven by, you know, our client and our client's interests. And, you know, as Edward said, in the aftermath of Fisher, we were really disappointed that schools did not take the opinion more seriously. That's part of it. Second part of it is, you know, this problem at Harvard and North Carolina, and particularly at Harvard, has been going on a really long time. And, you know, frankly, I don't think our client and our members are prepared to wait any longer to have it remedied. You know, every year there are thousands of kids being discriminated against at these schools, and you know, I just don't think we're prepared to wait any longer. In terms of whether that, you know, I'll leave to others the gauging about the individual justices and the right time to get them. You know, from my, you know, having clerked there, my feeling has always been that trying to guess how a particular justice is going to, you know, resolve a particular issue is really tough, even when you work there. And I'm probably not brave enough to hazard a guess as to how that's going to turn out, but we're prepared to let the chips fall where they may.
I'll just add a personal note to that, and I think Will answered it well, is it, when you're contacted by a family, and their son or daughter has spent, you know, the last 8 to 10 years putting in the extra effort, sacrificing play and recreation in order to be accepted to a school like Harvard or Yale or Columbia, to not take that case, to try and time it so that, you know, perhaps there's a change on the high court or a change in the appellate courts. You can't say no to what Will properly pointed out are hundreds, really thousands every year that are being discriminated against simply because of an accident of their birth. So I would rather, I don't think either of these cases will do harm to our efforts, but I'm always hesitant to try and sort of time these kinds of cases to fit with a theory of when the court might be ready and when the court might not be ready. It's comes down to personal decisions about these kids who have labored and have been discriminated against, and you know, the sooner we end this, the better.
We've now got two questions pending. Let's take another call here. Plenty of time left.
Hello, this is Joshua Thompson from Pacific Legal Foundation. I joined the call a little bit late. If you could just go over the procedural posture of the two cases right now, when I assume motions to dismiss are being filed, and when you expect those responses to be due, so when AC briefs would be due, and also if you've given any thought to AC topics that you'd like to be written about.
Yeah, this is Will Consovoy. Harvard's motion to dismiss or answer is due on February 18, and that's all. We've already given them an extension, so we anticipate that will be the filing date. North Carolina is presently due, I believe, they have two different dates because service was affected on some of the defendants on one day and some on the other, but the earlier date, I believe, is January 20, although that may end up getting pushed back too, and likely probably till after Harvard. And so We expect, I suppose they might file a motion to dismiss. You know, again, if you given Fisher, I'm not sure what they're going to say, given that they don't deny using race, and that triggers strict scrutiny. And once you're in strict scrutiny, they bear the burden, and they can't meet a burden without filing a pleading. So I'll be curious to see what those motions have to say if they file them. In terms of amicus briefs, we would be thrilled to have the support. I don't think we've thought too much about topics yet because we need to see, you know, what kind of arguments those schools make. But we certainly will be following up with many people as we see them and sharing ideas and topics, and we'll be happy to field calls and talk about that, you know, individually.
Do you anticipate filing extensions yourselves if motions to dismiss are filed, or are you going to stick to the timelines and the rules?
We're going to wait and see. To be honest, we just need to see what they do and see what, you know, whether, you know, how we need to respond to that. It's probably too early to tell, but we will certainly try to make people who are interested in helping aware of exactly what we're doing as we make those decisions.
Will, it's Edward chiming in. When would amicus briefs be due if Harvard's response is on the, what did you say, February the 17th?
18th, yeah. So 18th, it depends right. on, it, you know, there's no district court rule, and I don't believe these district courts have rules, although we're still looking into that, or informal operating procedures on that. Most people end up filing the rules. It's either negotiated among the parties, which we may do, or they follow the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure rule, which is 7 days after the party you're supporting. So if everybody follows that rule, which is a good possibility, then it would be, you know, 7 days after we file, and we may file, you know, 15, 30, 45 days, 60 even afterwards, depending on what we need to do in terms of extensions.
Okay.
We've got one question pending now. If you would like to ask a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg again. I wanted to ask you all, just more generally, and you've touched on this already, but on what other people can do to help you in what you're doing, and you know, how open you are to people contacting you with possible possible lawsuits. I also wanted just to mention quickly that on the question of racially exclusive scholarships, you're quite right that there are a number of variables, but in addition to who funds it, I think if the university is involved not in the funding but is involved in the selection of the students, that's probably enough of a nexus to make the university liable. But anyway, if people know about racially exclusive scholarships that their children are not eligible for, or are you interested in hearing from them? And just, you know, how many phone calls do you want to get?
Since this is Edward Blumanser, but since Will Consovoy and Tom McCarthy now have formed their own firm, I think the short answer, Roger, is the more the better. the Students for Fair Admissions .org is a very comprehensive two-way website. We encourage, you know, any student who has been rejected from any competitive university to go to the site, tell us what happened, ask us to contact them, and we are anxious to file additional lawsuits. So either through a phone call to Will or Tom or myself, or through the website, we encourage students to contact us.
That's great.
Yeah, and we're absolutely looking for more, Roger, and on these other related issues in terms of scholarships. If there's as you said, if there's a good case out there, we'd all like to look at it. So people should feel free to email us. You can, you know, consovoymccarthy.com. Our emails are on there. Feel free to reach out to us that way as well.
We've got another question.
You have a lawyer.
We've got another question now, so let's take another call.
Hi, do you anticipate these cases proceeding to trial, or will it be more like Fisher where it was decided, on stipulations or at summary judgment?
This is Will Consovoy. You know, too early to tell. You know, we are preparing. You know, we have requested a jury trial. So we are prepared and, you know, ready to go to trial if that's required to win these cases. It depends on the kind of discovery we end up seeing, I think, and the kind of arguments we see from these schools. But there certainly are some fact issues here, you know, in terms of what's going on at these universities. And so I would think there's a greater chance of trial here than there certainly was in, you know, in Fisher. Fisher, there was really, the university had almost no evidence to submit. You know, here when you're talking about allegations of invidious discrimination, I think we're prepared to get to the bottom of it any way we have to.
Let me make another call for questions here. If you've got a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I think I interrupted maybe the caller. Did you have a follow-up question?
No, I did not.
Okay. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. I don't see any further questions, gentlemen. Let me, since we have a couple minutes left, ask you each if you have a final thought you want to express before we adjourn the call.
Will,
go ahead.
You know, first of all, thanks for everybody for dialing in and giving us a chance to talk about these cases. Obviously, we think these are, you know, to our mind, very important cases. We do think that these two cases get to the heart of the matter in ways that other cases haven't. And, you know, we are anxious to see. We're dealing with, you know, Harvard is obviously perhaps the most well-known university in the country, and North Carolina, if I'm correct, is the oldest public university in the country. And so these plaintiffs were chosen, these defendants were chosen for a reason. You know, we appreciate the support, and we are anxious to see them in court.
This is Edward Blum. I'll close on sort of a request that and a reminder that thousands of students, tens of thousands of students, will be receiving acceptance and rejection letters in April and May of this year. Any listener who is aware of a highly qualified student who is rejected from a competitive university, to please contact us either through the website or at the Project on Fair Representation or Will and Tom. We would like to file, you know, a handful of these claims throughout the country and ask for the Federalist Society help in doing so. That's it.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Ed, let me give you a chance to give the website address one more time.
Yes, it's studentsforfairadmissions.org.
All one word, I take it.
All one word, Dean, yes.
Terrific. Well, thank you both so much. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Edward Blum. He's the director of the Project for Fair Representation, and Will Consovoy, a partner at the new law firm Consovoy McCarthy. This has been an excellent presentation. Ongoing litigation, obviously, so we look forward to the possibility of having you back in the future as these cases move along. I'd like to keep track of them myself. I'm sure our audience would as well. To our audience, thanks for joining in. Thanks for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about Common Core and public education. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.